This is Talk Back Gardening with Deb Tribe and Sophie Thompson.
On 891, ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good morning and welcome to Talk Back Gardening. Good morning, Sophie.
Good morning, Deb, and good morning, listeners.
We have got lots of lines free if you'd like to speak to Sophie. 1300 222 891 is the number to call. I have a couple of ABC Gardening magazines to give away later in the program. We love your comments on the text line, which is 0467 922 891. But we're going to start today with a serious subject. You recently visited Kangaroo Island, Sophie, and over there I think you met someone from Perza talking about varroa mite, and you said we should be talking about that next week, which was what we had planned. And then yesterday, unfortunately, we heard that varroa mite has been detected in beehives in the Limestone Coast region near Salt Creek, triggering manage arrangements to help contain its spread. And I think you said to me earlier in the week, Sophie, it's a matter of not if, but when it will arrive here.
Well, unfortunately, that's what many people believe, and I'll be interested to hear what Sky says. But the thing is, I think, if anything, people are a little bit complacent. And I know I was talking to the PERSA officer, David A., on the island, and, you know, they think, if anything, there are some beekeepers on the island that just think, oh, look, it's not going to be a challenge over here. Well, you know, it got from New Zealand to Australia, so that little distance, it's an incredibly persistent creature. So let's hear more from Dr. Sky.
Yes, Dr. Sky Fruin is South Australia's Chief Veterinary Officer who joins us now. Sky, good morning.
Good morning.
Before we talk about what needs to be done, can you just tell us a little bit about the detection that's occurred in the Limestone Coast region?
Yeah, no problems. I mean, you've summarised it pretty well. The detection happened earlier this week. We received a report from a beekeeper in the Salt Creek area that they suspected maybe they had varroa mite. Our officers have been out and collected samples, and that has been confirmed as a detection.
There's two things. One is what happens for commercial beekeepers, but the other one is for home gardeners and what they need to do. So for the commercial beekeepers, what's involved?
Well, for any beekeepers, recreational or commercial, the advice is the same, that they should be managing varroa mite. Now, there's a range of things that entails. So first and foremost, monitoring. So there's a couple of different methods that can be used to check your hives as to whether you've got varroa. And how often you should be doing that does depend a bit on how big the risk is. We have been saying beekeepers should be doing that about four times a year. If you are in the vicinity of a detection, such as in that Salt Creek area, we'd be recommending doing it more often. And our officers are out in that sort of vicinity trying to proactively contact beekeepers in the area. To support them in doing that.
So for say if someone's got a backyard beehive, you know, I've been involved with the Beekeepers of South Australia, and I've always been promoting people go along to an organisation to get training on how to manage a hive. I know that PERSA has been running all sorts of education courses for people with backyard hives, and it's really important that people do take part in these, isn't it, Skye?
Absolutely is. And the best way to find out about them is to go to the website, but also to register with PERSA your beehive. If you have less than four beehives, that's free. So it costs you nothing. And what that will get you is, you know, advance notice of when we are running training courses. And you can also obviously have direct line to PERSA in terms of contacting us if you're interested in having one-on-one training or any sort of support in terms of equipment, things like that. So we do have varroa development officers that have been with us for some time now since the national transition to management plan came in about for varroa to support SA beekeepers in preparing for varroa and managing it once it arrives.
And so for people that don't know much about varroa, it's a little sap-sucking mite. It can survive, I believe, for quite a long time without a host, which means that if there was a dead bee in your grill and you travelled to KI, theoretically, you know, it could get over there. Isn't that right?
theoretically, I think the other challenge is it's quite prolific and it's quite hard to pick up early when it is in a in a colony, in a hive. Mm-hmm. So that's the challenge we have from the original detection up in Pudgenook, is that, you know, we're still monitoring up there to determine if it's even established up in that region, because you can't tell immediately. And we'll have that same challenge down around Salt Creek.
Okay. But the thing is that if someone's just heard about varroa and how devastating it's going to be to bees, overseas in Italy or Europe, they have been dealing with it for decades, haven't they? So there is a way of managing it, but it will have an impact.
Yeah, exactly right. So in managed hives, so that's recreational or commercial, there are tools for managing it. So the monitoring I mentioned earlier is the tool for finding whether you've got it. And if you do find varroa, obviously at this point in time, when it's not established in SA, we'd be wanting you to report those to PRRSA immediately on the Exotic Plant Pest Hotline. But down the track, when it gets to the point of being endemic, so being here and something we just need to learn to live with, there are ways to manage it. So there's a range of chemical treatments that kill the mite. There's also a range of other sort of management techniques you can use. And we have a lot of information on our own website as well as the national website around that integrated pest management.
Fantastic. Now, for someone that's just a, you know, home gardener and they've got a veggie patch and they've got fruit trees, and so bee pollination is obviously important to them, what can they do to support the bees in their garden? A few weeks ago, the reason I wanted to talk bees is a few weeks ago we had people ringing up saying, oh, there's not any bees in my garden. But by the end of the program, we'd had enough people ringing up saying, I've got plenty of bees in my garden, to sort of feel like, well, they're there if you look after them.
Yeah, exactly. If you don't have your own hive, depending on how many fruit trees you have, I mean, you can, there are pollination services out there, but in terms of encouraging, I think you're talking more about wild bees, planting things that bees like to eat. Mm. I mean, it's as simple as that, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously honeybees too, they need water to survive in the really hot weather. Anyone that's ever had a bird bath or something with water on it, so having bees out, having water out for bees when it's really hot. The thing about it gets a little bit confusing because we've got a whole lot of native bees that do amazing pollination services, but we haven't really been looking at them. There's 2,000 species across Australia, 300 odd around Adelaide. But people often say, yes, I've got native bees. They live in the tree hollow out the back. They're not native bees, are they? They're really feral honeybees.
Yeah, well, without seeing what you're looking at, quite possibly native bees, is a few, like you said, there's many different species. They tend to be a bit smaller than the honeybees. The good thing about varroa is that, if there is a good thing, it doesn't affect native bees. So if you do have native bees in your backyard, they will be safe from this mite.
Yeah. And but what varroa might affect, and this is where home gardeners, as I understand it, might get impacted, is that feral honeybee colony living in the dead tree, because that's not managed, that will be vulnerable to the effects of varroa when not if, I'm going to say, or we, you know, should varroa get established.
Yeah, you're right. Absolutely.
And so so for home gardeners, the best thing they can do for the moment is make sure you've got flowers to support bees, water to support bees. And if you do have a lot of fruit trees and a lot of veggies, you know, and you've got your own personal hive, certainly get on the PRRSA website and find out all the details.
Absolutely. Yeah, thank you.
Our special guest is Dr. Skye Frewen, South Australia's Chief Veterinary Officer. We're talking about varroa mite. It's been found in beehives in the Limestone Coast region near Salt Creek. Of course, it was first detected in Australia back in 2022. We had our first detection in South Australia at Pudgenook in the Riverland in September of this year. Skye, just coming back to what's happened to the beehive keepers in the Limestone Coast, a biosecurity notice has been issued to those particular beekeepers, and the South Australia Varroa Industry Advisory Committee has met, you know, looking at what needs to happen across the state.
Yeah, that's correct. So we're sending out that biosecurity notice, and we are sending them out regularly, but one did go out this week in relation to the detection. That's going out to all registered beekeepers. So that's another sort of reason, like as I mentioned earlier, that if you are a beekeeper with hives, to please ensure that you're registered with us so that you're getting the latest information directly.
Well, along with contacting PRRSA for training, as you know, Sophie was recommending, you're asking all South Australian beekeepers to inspect their hives regularly using alcohol wash, sugar shake or sticky mat techniques, and report any suspected detections immediately to PRRSA via the Exotic Plant Pest Hotline. That number is 1-800-084-881. And the big thing is, no matter how many hives you've got, register with PRRSA so that you actually get this information, which is really, really important to do. So is there anything else you'd like to say, Skye, before we let you go this morning?
Just quickly, yeah, so besides the information that you'd get in terms of updates on the detection through those notices, is also we are sending out a lot of information about how to perform monitoring and treatments and things like that. So there's a lot of resources available, which you can find yourself on the website if you want to go looking. But Varroa Development Officers are fantastic, and they're doing a lot of work out directly with beekeepers to support them. So that is a tool that we have available that beekeepers can tap into.
It's not a great topic. We were hoping to talk about prevention. I mean, we are talking about prevention as well, but it's a shame that this particular detection has occurred. But it was a matter of when it might be spread, I imagine. So thank you very much for telling us about it this morning.
Not a problem. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. Dr. Skye Frewen, South Australia's Chief Veterinary Officer. And look, just on the text line, quite a few texts on this, Sophie. Thank you for talking about this. Can you please highlight the need for visitors to KI to make sure they're not endangering our unique Ligurian bees on the island? Being responsible when entering a bee sanctuary isn't just about not packing honey in your bag. It's about being aware if you've been somewhere where bees are active, making sure you don't inadvertently give them a lift to KI. As you said, Sophie, to wash or hose down your car. If you've driven through a swarm, check there isn't a hive before packing your caravan. Please help us keep our bee colony safe. That's Shah on KI. Jane says, my giant salvia bush is full of wild honeybees. It's a food magnet for them with a couple of bird baths close by. Bee heaven. And says it's a worry about that mite. This texter asks, is there anything a gardener with fruit trees but not a beehive can do?
Well, at the moment, not particularly. However, I would also say that, you know, what you need to do is get more educated about native bees. Their pollination services haven't really been understood. We now know that blue-banded bees are amazing for your tomatoes or any crop that needs to be buzz-pollinated. So tomatoes that are pollinated by blue-banded bees are bigger and tastier, scientifically proven. So the thing is to make sure that you get educated about how to attract as many native bees into your garden and their pollination services, and just, you know, it is going to be a bit of a suck it and see. You know, I think some people might actually take up hosting honeybee hives if they've got a lot of fruit trees. But, you know, the thing is that you've got to get educated. What makes me slightly nervous is when I meet people that have got a hive and go, yeah, I'll be right. You know, I'll just Google. And Google is amazing, but you need some first-hand information from people that know what they're talking about, and the PRRSA officers are fantastic.
Carolyn says, I always have hundreds of bees. I plant borage and they love it, as do the strawberry plants, which is wonderful. So thanks for your text. We are going to get back into your talkback gardening calls in just a moment. 1-300-222-891 is the number.
This is Talk Back Gardening with Deb Tribe and Sophie Thompson.
On 891 ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Alan is in Strathalbyn. Alan, you have bought a property with lots of fruit trees on it. Good morning.
Actually, we're in Wilmington. We have moved from Strathalbyn.
So, beautiful. Yeah. Gorgeous place.
It is. Yeah, we love it here.
I bet. How can we help you?
Yeah, Sophie, we've got a lot of, the previous owners planted a lot of fruit trees, apricots, nectarines, peaches, plums, cherries, mulberries, and they're all covered in leaves and new growth and not a huge amount of fruit. But I'm just wondering if they've been pruned at the wrong time.
How old do you reckon they are?
Probably about 5 years old, except for one mulberry tree, which is probably about 90 years old.
Oh, okay, beautiful. Okay, so the reality is if they've been pruned in winter, what that does is that stimulates a whole lot of growth, whereas what you want to do over time is get to where you're more summer pruning. And by summer pruning, we tend to talk about after you've taken fruit of, you know, things like peaches or nectarines off, and you can reduce up to 30%. Obviously not when it's particularly hot, you know, you choose your week. And winter pruning, you still do winter pruning, but not so much. You know, if you keep winter pruning plums, they are so vigorous, they're just going to put all their energy into growth. So what summer pruning does, if we think of the leaves of a tree like the plant's solar panels, the more leaves it's got, the more energy it produces, so the more growth it has. So summer pruning is basically reducing the solar panels managing the tree. So you want, and the other thing is, I think we're all of a mindset now that you do not want a tree that you have to get up a ladder to manage. We want to keep trees so that you can harvest from the ground. And so, you know, with the different types of trees, particularly nectarines, peaches, and if you've got plums, definitely doing summer pruning after fruiting will reduce the size of the tree. And then next year in winter, you might say, okay, well, look, there's a couple of crossing limbs here. You know, that's what you don't want. And you can do a little bit of formative pruning or shape pruning. But generally, you want to move to where you're doing more summer pruning and less winter pruning. But in a harsh climate like yours, you also have to be aware of the fact that you don't want to do too much summer pruning to open the trunk up to get sunburnt. So you want a little bit of cover, but it's a healthy balance. I actually had Ian Tolley staying with me last night, and as the sun was setting, we were out and Ian couldn't resist. He brought secateurs with him. I've got trees that went in winter time, and we were giving them a little nip. It's not really summer pruning time yet, but we were just sort of looking at how you can force more growth.
Oh, okay. Okay. Sophie, thanks very much for that. Thank you.
All the best.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alan. Appreciate your call on 1300 222 891. Elizabeth is in Marion. Elizabeth, you've got some onion weed that's challenging your lemon tree. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, I've got it's not me, it's a relative. So it's onion weed and it's currently flowering and it's under a fruit tree. It's either a lemon or a lime. And it's covering about 3 metres area in the Prospect suburb.
Yep.
And I was wondering how to deal with that.
So this is the one that has a pretty little bell, white bells. Sort of looks a bit bluebellish, but it has a top knot rather than a proper. And when you crush the foliage, it's quite garlicky?
No, I haven't gone to that length. It looks like a little white flower to me, you know, just having a quick look.
Yep. Okay. So the first off, for people that when they say onion weed, the thing you're talking about I think is actually three-cornered garlic. Onion weed is a weed I have on my property, and you see it right up through the Flinders Ranges, and it's a different flower again. But from what you're describing, I think you've got three-cornered garlic. Now, the challenge is you don't want to let it seed, but just pulling the leaves and flowers off isn't really solving the problem. It can be removed manually if you've got like a little hand trowel, and you have to do it when the soil is really moist and you put your trowel in deep and you make sure you try and get the bulbs out. Now, you know, if it's been growing there for a long time, there's probably quite a lot of seed in the soil, and it will take a while to get rid of. But I do know Tim Marshall, who's the organics guru, he removed it from about a tennis court sized area of his garden by hand weeding. So hand weeding, making sure you get the bulb not just pulling the flowers and the stems and foliage off.
But would it help just to cut off the flowering hairs at this time until he gets the opportunity, soak all the ground, and then when he gets the opportunity to dig it up?
Okay, yes, it would. It would, actually. So great thought. So that you're not adding seed to the ground to get rid of the flowers, but, you know, just know that there will be a seed bank in that soil if it's been let go for a while. And, it might be that every year he goes, okay, when the ground's really wet in late autumn or winter, I'm going to get there on my hands and knees and I'm going to spend a bit of time pulling out what I can. And, you know, just don't expect to do it overnight, but if you can be persistent, you will get it under control.
Sorry, when did you say the month to do it?
Well, you might. So if you get the flower heads off now so it doesn't make more seed, you might decide to wait until next autumn, late autumn or winter when the ground is really moist and dig then, you know. So even though they won't have flowers on, you could get them up then. So, but, you know, it's going to be a process. It's not going to happen quickly.
Okay. Thank you so very much.
Thanks. All the best.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Yeah. Cameron is in Tumby Bay with a couple of magnolia trees. Hi, Cameron.
Morning, guys. How you going?
Great. Thank you.
That's a go. I've got two magnolia trees in my front garden, which basically get all northern and western sun. And I've got one really healthy one and about 5 metres away, one not so healthy, and it's got really yellow leaves with the odd burnt leaf. Okay. I'm wondering what it could be.
Can you tell me first off what magnolia it is? Is it one like Little Gem or Teddy Bear?
I'm pretty sure it's a Little Gem. They're both Little Gem.
Okay. So first off, let me tell you, Tumby Bay probably wouldn't be their desired climate.
Okay.
So the fact you've got one doing well, I'm really impressed with.
Right.
So the one that's not doing well, is that closer to gum trees or big trees or root competition?
It's in the lawn. So one's in the lawn and one's not. So I'm wondering, is it getting that dry from the lawn,
or is it? So yeah. How what's the ring that you've kept the lawn back from it?
Probably, I would say half a metre.
Okay. So can I ask you to make it bigger? Make it a metre. So magnolias have a fleshy root system, and they, you know, as a general rule of thumb, you'd say they want twice as much water and twice as much nutrient as any other tree when they're getting established, right? So when you've got lawn, and it's probably a tough lawn like Kikuyu or Cooch?
It is Tiff Tough, Bermuda Tiff Tough.
Okay. So it will be taking a lot of the water and a lot of the goodness. So if you can pull the lawn back and maybe even give that tree supplementary watering so that you can you know, give it a bit extra. So the one is thriving because it hasn't got the competition. And, you know, the other thing is feeding. So, you know, if you've got a general purpose organic fertilizer, I would be giving the one that's not thriving a bit extra. So, you know, they're amazing trees. And if you can get them established, I mean, the only other thing you'd think about would be to decide whether there's, you know, poorer soil underneath that one that's not thriving well. But yes, certainly, you know, make sure it has a good mulch around it, like a good woody based mulch. You know, you could even add some compost before you put the mulch on.
Yep. All right. So I was a bit worried I was overwatering it, but I didn't think I was. So I might, give a little bit more water and I'll give that a go and see how we go.
And just keep the lawn back more. Just bear in mind that, you know, lawns are fantastic and they make things cooler, but while you're trying to get trees established, they can give you tree competition.
Yep. No, awesome. Thank you.
Awesome. That's where we like to hear on a Saturday morning. Thank you, Cameron from Tumby Bay. We've got some lines free if you'd like to speak to Sophie Thompson. Thank you to Irene from Clare, who called to let everyone know that there's plenty of rain up her way. She's sitting in her car watching the kids play tennis with the rain falling. Sounds great, Irene. The phone line is 1300 222 891. The text line is 0467 922 891. Jordan sent through a beautiful photograph of dwarf sunflowers in full bloom, pure happiness, says to everybody, have a beautiful day. Thank you, Jordan. Same to you as well. And Margaret from Parkside, Sophie, says, thank you for alerting me to the timing of the gall wasp eruption. I bought the last pot of goo from my local hardware store, applied it, and the rest can be seen in my photo. Lots of large and small wasps all caught in the goo. Hooray. Good on you, Margaret. That's the sort of news we like to have. So thank you very much for that. We will come back to more of your texts and phone calls very soon.
This is Talk Back Gardening with Deb Tribe and Sophie Thompson
on 891 ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good morning and welcome to Talk Back Gardening. Good morning, Sophie.
Good morning, Deb, and good morning, listeners.
Lovely to have your company this morning. If you'd like to speak to Sophie, the number to call is 1300 222 891. I have a couple of ABC Gardening magazines to give away, one by phone and one by text, and we welcome your comments on 0467 922 891. We've received some lovely entries in our indoor jungle photographic competition, but we'd like more. So if you'd like to find out what to do, you just need to email one photograph, just one, make it your best, of either a special indoor plant or an area of greenery inside your house. And you need to just tell us in 40 words or less why you want to celebrate that. You might win the plant book, The Ultimate Guide to Thriving Houseplants by Tammy Huynh, who we spoke to last week from Gardening Australia. And I've got some runner-up prize packs of ABC Gardening Australia and Organic Gardener magazines to give away as well. So just one photo, 40 words or less, why you love it, and send us all of your details, your name, your address and your phone number, and send it into Adelaide Weekends with an S, adelaideweekends@abc.net.au. It all closes on the 1st of December, so get to it if you can this week. We'd love to receive them and look forward to giving you some great pre-Christmas presents. Right now, let's jump to the phones. John is in Ferradon Park. Now, you've got a grevillea and a peach, and they're not looking so great, John. Welcome.
Good morning. How are you?
Great, thank you. Are your trees?
Well, as I dabble into the gardening world and I get more experience, I find I get interesting challenges. And this challenge is interesting in the sense that I've got an Australian grevillea and a peach tree that I sowed. Both of them have got green veins and yellow leaves. And the interesting thing about it is I've also checked the pH and it's more alkaline, because I've been putting out compost and the correct fertiliser, but I'm a little bit baffled. I'm wondering how to fix the pH, possibly, because it's looking towards the alkaline or 7, or a miracle fertiliser that can fix the problem up, because the leaves are showing signs that they need fixing.
Are they both in the same area of the garden, John, or are they just different areas?
Well, I've decided to use the natives to bring in native birds and bees and stuff. So I put the grevillea in the middle around the fruit trees, and it's 2 metres, about 2.5 metres away from the peach tree, maybe 3.
Okay. Well, first off, just to be reassured, most of Adelaide is alkaline, right? Everywhere out where I am, it's alkaline. You know, that's just what it is. You don't necessarily need to panic. And if it's coming near 7, that's actually quite neutral. I wouldn't say that's alkaline at all. Now, the challenge is, though, that those pH test kits, the little ones you buy from the shops, they're great on your virgin soil, as in your unimproved soil, your unadulterated soil. But as soon as you start adding compost to it, it stops them working accurately, because the lignin in the compost impedes the pH test kit giving you an accurate reading. So, you know, you could pay for really expensive soil tests and they would then give you an accurate pH. But I think the best thing to do is when you look at the leaves of a plant and they're yellowy with darker green veins, generally it means that the plant has got something called lime-induced chlorosis. And how we can fix that is by using two things. One is by making sure that the plant is well fed. When you put a balanced, say, organic fertilizer out on the plant can take what it wants when it wants it. But if there's a deficiency, using something like iron chelates can actually correct that deficiency. So that's what I'd be looking to use. You know, if you've done everything else right, I would also avoid alkaline products. So things like if you use mushroom compost, it can be quite alkaline. So generally you use a balanced compost that's not alkaline and add that to your soil. It sounds like you've done everything right. Now I just use iron chelates. There are. I will also say that some grevilleas come from acid soil regions, so they are often chlorotic in our soils. So it may well be that it's one from another part of Australia. While it's climate compatible, if it's one with big, you know, big flowers and big leaves, they are often
a honey type. It's a honey type grevillea. I remember it.
Okay, so look, get some iron chelates and, you know, treat the soil and even take a photo of the leaf now and then look at the leaf, you know, after a month of treatment, and you might find, okay, it's greened up a bit. Still not quite there, might take a couple of treatments, but you can see the difference. So definitely take a photo of the foliage so you've got something to compare it with.
And Sophie, I've got another type of shellite product. Would I spray it on the leaves or put it in the soil or both?
I'd do both. I would do both, okay. Absolutely. And, you know, when it's cooler like this, it's perfect to be doing it.
Okay. And with that particular product, does it matter how many times I put it on the plants in 2-3 weeks' time, so to speak?
You do it until the deficiency is corrected, right? So,
every month, so to speak, is that what you've got?
Absolutely. And, you know, following the instructions on the packet, do it as required. And as soon as the plant's looking healthy, you don't need to do it anymore. So, good luck with that, John.
And don't worry about balancing out ammonium sulfate or something to balance out the pH of the soil.
No, because A, you're not getting an accurate reading because of your pH test kit, because the organic matter you've added has changed that. If you've got, you know, virgin soil, do it like, you know, basic soil, you can do it, but otherwise I wouldn't.
All right, mate. Well, I'll give it a go and I'll give you a buzz in 2-3 months and see how I go.
Sounds great, John. Good on you.
All right, mate. Have a good day.
Thanks, John. Stacey is in Cleve. Stacey, you've planted some zucchini and cucumber pumpkin. How are they going?
Oh, well, it's not what's eating Gilbert grape, Sophie and Deb. It's what's eating Stacey's vegetables.
Oh, my gosh.
I think it's earwigs, Sophie. I'm not sure. I feel very disheartened because I only let them have a sleepover on the kitchen bench one night. It went straight out.
Oh, you're dropping in and out there, Stacey.
You think
it's earwigs? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
That's right. So I planted them after they'd had a sleepover only one night in the kitchen. So they were very fresh and alive and lovely big leaves.
Yep.
Went in the next morning just a stalk.
Yeah, okay.
And so also, do I need to put another cucumber in? Has that effectively sort of died, Sophie, or is the plant laying dormant and it will revive?
Oh, if it's eaten your only leaves, you may well need to put another plant in, I'm sorry to say.
Okay. But that's all right.
So earwigs are shocking this year. And as a matter of fact, when you put earwigs and also slaters can do a similar thing. So what I'm going to tell you about is making an earwig trap. So you get like a dip container You can actually buy what we call a snail bait caddy, but if you can't get that where you live in Cleve, you get a dip container that's empty or a takeaway container. You put some, you put the lid on and put some holes just under the lid so that the earwigs can crawl in there. Then you nestle it so that it's in the soil and the earwigs can walk along, walk straight through those holes. And then what you put in the container is you put cheap vegetable oil, about a centimetre, and a drizzle of soy sauce. So you're looking for that balsamic olive oil dipping look, if you know what I mean.
Sure, and, yeah, all right.
So what happens is you will get huge numbers. Now, the great thing about having a dip container with a lid on it is that basically if you're watering, you're not filling it with water, it can stay there for a week. Usually at the end of a week, you've got a marinated dip container of earwigs, and if you have chooks, they'll think it's fantastic. They think it's Chinese takeaway.
Great.
Okay, so it's a win-win. And particularly when there's been drought, earwigs and numbers like that can get out of sync. So I'm about to do one of those traps this afternoon, so I need the same thing. And then the other thing is, next time you plant, put a collar on the seedling. So get, say, plastic milk bottles and cut the bottom off, cut the top off, just put that collar, scrape the mulch away just for a couple of a short period, and put that collar around your seedling so that the creatures can't crawl up to it to get established.
Thanks, Sophie. So I don't need anything like eco oil, just the homemade
That won't work at
Chinese takeaway for chooks. Great.
Yeah, absolutely. Cheap vegetable oil and a drizzle of soy sauce. Good luck with that. Oh, let us know how you go, Stacey.
Thanks a lot.
Lovely to hear from you, Stacey. Stacey in Cleve. Next caller is Sue in Brighton with an orange tree question. Hi, Sue.
Oh, good morning. I have an orange tree. It is at least 40 years old. It's always done its own thing. It's always been prolific. But this year, and I think it may have started last year around this time, when the leaves and it starts to fruit, there's a little bit of dieback and there's a little bit more this year. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if the tree, I don't know what the age, what age trees start, orange trees start to peter out. It does have some geraniums and canna lilies around the perimeter of the tree, you know, out further from the drip line. Which, you know, are encroaching slowly, but they're not, you know, really underneath the tree. I was just wondering what I can do to it's got some lovely new growth happening at the moment, but not a huge amount. There's obvious dead branches, twigs.
Yep. Okay. So before we get, you know, lost in complications, I would just look at the basic thing. Is it drying out? Now, last year was the driest year on record. Lots of people said to me, oh, I'm watering the same as I always do. That wasn't enough last year because there was no subsoil moisture. So, and that can be one of the simplest things. And then you've got things like canna lilies, which, you know, will suck all the moisture up. So you might say, I'm putting water on, but they're taking it. So that would be the first thing I would look at. The other thing I would look at is nutrition. So now, just going back to the watering, now Ian Tolley's actually doing a workshop for me up in the Mid-Murray today, and I'm sure we'll hear lots of this sort of comment, that you, to know if you're giving adequate water, you touch the leaf in the middle of the day on a warm day. If it's cool to the touch, it's hydrated. If it's not, it's dry. And people often think, oh, yeah, I'm giving it plenty. And then they touch and they go, wow, that's really interesting, because basically trees are an evaporative air conditioning system. They draw moisture through their roots and pass it out through their leaves, so you should be able to feel the cool. The other thing is nutrition. So, you know, trees, citrus are suitable to our climate if we give them supplementary watering, but our soils are pretty old and pretty poor, so they need quite a bit of feed. And Ian talks about using an organic seaweed-based pelletized fertilizer and applying some monthly, not just twice a year. He talks about putting it on monthly, and what that does is it's putting on a smorgasbord, which means the plant can take what it wants when it wants it. But I would start with watering, Sue. You know, citrus trees elsewhere can live for a long time. You know, why not nurture it this year and see how it goes? Cut off any dead bits, and you know, just keep an eye and give it the moisture and nutrition it needs for this season and see how you go.
Okay, thank you very much. I have chooks. I have a mandarin tree and a lemon tree, and they thrive with the chook poo, but I tend not to put it under the orange tree because it's quite close to my back door.
So they, it might be a little bit hungry.
Yes. Okay, I shall follow that advice. Thank you very
much.
Good
on you. See you soon.
We have got a couple of ABC gardening magazines to give away if you haven't won anything from the ABC in the last month. We'll do one by phone on 1300 222 891 if you'd like to put your full name and postal address on a text message, especially if you're listening to us via the ABC Listen app or digitally. You'd like to win a magazine, you can text that through to 0467 922 891.
This is Talk Back Gardening with Deb Tribe and Sophie Thompson
on 891 ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good to have your company on this Saturday morning. Sophie Thompson, our wonderful talkback gardener here. Lots of people in the queue to talk to you, Sophie. Lisa is in Colonel Light Gardens. Lisa, good morning to you. You're having some problems with your nashi pear.
Yes. Hi, good morning all. I've got a nashi pear that's espaliated, and last year had lots of leaves and growth compared to my bare bosh, but no fruit at all. The year before, we had, you know, quite a few pears. And now this year, it's looking like it's got lots of foliage again. So just wondering what might be happening there.
Okay. So, Lisa, when you're espaliering something, you're having to prune it all the time. Basically, you're working against the plant. Can you tell me, does it have fruiting spurs? Bear in mind, pears fruit on fruiting spurs. And those spurs are permanent and they last for many, many years. So yes. Mm-hmm. If you accidentally, you know, when it puts on this thicket of growth, if you keep cutting that back and accidentally cut some spurs off, that could be the problem.
Right, yeah, because I haven't been pruning it at all. I didn't prune it last, or maybe I did. Accidentally the year before pruned something back. So I've left it this year. You know, haven't pruned anything, so I'm hoping. So I've got to look for fruiting spurs. I'll have to Google that.
Yeah, you do. So do look up. So spur, if you think of like a spur that you'd put on your shoe, you know, it's a little sticky bit. Can be, you know, a couple of centimetres long, and that's usually what flowers. And if there's lots, and so that's what flowers, so therefore that's what fruits. Now, if you've got lots of foliage and you do, if you have spurs but you've got all this growth, the growth could be shading the spur.
Yes.
So the spur isn't getting enough light, so therefore it doesn't flower. So one is to look for spurs, and then the other is to keep managing the growth, because when the plant puts its energy into growth, it's not putting its energy into flowering or fruiting. We're not wanting to cut all that growth off. We're just wanting to reduce it. So, it would definitely be worthwhile getting on the internet, Googling, pruning, you know, a pear tree as an espalier, and then going out and looking for the spurs on your tree.
Wonderful. Thank you. And also with the, you were talking before about touching the leaf in the middle of the day, is that the same for all fruit trees and trees for watering?
Really it is. But actually with something like a pear or other fruit trees, you can often spot, you know, their wilting is a bit more obvious.
Obvious, yes, correct.
So, you know, but theoretically, yes, absolutely. So, and, you know, pears are wonderful trees. They're deep-rooted. You know, as long as it's in the right position and it does get some sun, they should live for a long time.
Yeah, and the watering in summertime, it's in 80 by 40 is the ground.
Yeah.
Is once a week a good water once a week enough in summer, or you need to do it twice a week?
No, I think a good water once a week, if you're on, you know, where you are, you've got probably got sort of heavier soil. You wouldn't have sandy soil.
No,
you know, a good soak once a week. Maybe, you know, if we're having a 40-degree week, you might make it twice a week, but you're far better to do, you know, a deep soak less often than a little bit all the time. The other thing is to make sure that, you know, the water is getting, you know, the aim of watering is to get water 30 centimetres into the soil profile and not just the top, you know, couple of centimetres. So
yes,
how do you check?
30 centimetres.
You know, dig after you've watered and see how far the water's penetrated.
Perfect.
And
thank you very much.
Hopefully we'll get some rain this afternoon so you're off the hook this week.
Thanks, Sophie. Thanks, team.
Thank you. Thanks, Lisa. Good luck with that. Congratulations to Julie in Christie's Beach and to Barbara at Seaford who have won the gardening magazines today. And Marie in Yeppoon says, listening on the ABC Listen app all the way from central Queensland. Love the program. Love listening to Talk Pet Gardening. That's great, Marie. Thank you very much for making contact with us. Lovely to hear from you. Bill is in Clarendon and you've got a locust tree question. Hi, Bill.
Oh, hello. In 1946, we went from Renella down to Morford Vale, and there was a huge locust tree, and we didn't know what it was. I was only six, and I didn't know what it was, and it was like a marvel. There was no flesh on it when we finally ate it. My neighbour now, I live, gave me, from down on the suburbs, gave me some locusts, and they're huge, and lots of flesh on them and great big stones. Where did the locusts originate from? Are they native, or did they come from overseas in the beginning? And can you plant them from the seeds if I want to grow one on the farm? But we don't have mains water, so we haven't got a lot of water.
Okay, great question. No, they're not native. They actually come from China, southwest China, and they are they do grow well from seed. As a matter of fact, they can sometimes self-seed, so you'll see them sort of growing along creek lines and everything like that, or, you know, in people's gardens. But they are a fabulous tree, beautiful evergreen foliage, lovely round-headed trees. When they're laden with fruit, they're amazing. When that fruit is fresh, they are fabulous. So if you've been given one, why not grow it and enjoy having a beautiful locust? You know, there's all sorts of recipes that you can do. So enjoy having a beautiful locust fresh from the tree. Nothing beats it.
Well, I've only been given the seeds, haven't been given a plant. So I'll fuss around for a plant if I want one.
Awesome, awesome. Well, you can find that or you can grow it from the seed. So good luck with that, Bill.
Yeah. Thank you for your information.
Thanks, Bill, for calling in, and thank you to the many callers that we had this morning. And don't forget, Sophie is back on tomorrow morning with Jason Chong from 11 until 12, so you've always got that opportunity to speak with Sophie. Sophie, what are some of the things that need to be done this weekend in the garden?
Okay, so, you know, everything, the most, if we go back to basics, mulching, right? If we're going to get this rain, how wonderful is that? Make sure you put mulch on top of the ground. Mulch literally reduces your water requirements by 70% and it keeps all those microbes and earthworms that we just love happy in the soil. So we go to all this trouble of improving our soil, you know, adding organic matter. If you haven't put mulch on the top, really, it's wasted. So if you've got the option, use woody-based mulch. So that's the bark-type mulches on woody plants. So that's your fruit trees, your roses, anything like that. If you've got veggies growing, you use straw-based mulches. So I tend to like pea straw. I'm not a fan of sugarcane because it comes on a truck from Queensland and it's got a carbon footprint that's massive before it even gets here. But any straw-based mulch on veggies is better. And the reason why, the woody-based mulch creates a fungal-dominated soil flora, whereas the straw-based mulch creates a bacterial-dominated soil flora. And that's putting your plants in their ideal soil habitat, and then they will thrive and reward you.
Mary from Cuddly Creek has sent through a beautiful picture of a self-seeded locust, as you were talking about locusts a little earlier. And Kaz from Wakery has sent through a beautiful picture of the Monstera, which has been split four times and still thriving. Now, you need to enter our indoor jungle competition. It doesn't work on the text line, Kaz, so if you've got a great photo and a lovely story for your indoor plants, you can just type in indoor jungle ABC and it will bring up the page that's got all of the details. But if you don't want to do that, you can just send it through to us via email with all of your contact details and why you love the plant, what it is, to Adelaide Weekends with an S at abc.net.au, and we will be judging those by the 1st of December. I think 1st of December, sorry, is when it closes, and we'll announce the winners in Talkback Gardening on the 6th of December. So please be a part of it. We'd love you to join us. Sophie, it's been a super busy week for you, as every week is in your life, and I look forward to doing it all over again with you next Saturday morning.
Look forward to it too, Deb. Happy gardening to all our listeners.